Hey everyone, welcome back to a new episode of On the Verge. Today's guest is Carrie Sun. She is a writer who was born in China and raised in Michigan. She holds an MFA in creative writing from the New School. Private Equity is her first book. In today's episode, we will be exploring the themes of the meaning of work, her journey of self-discovery and changing her professional path, advice for the quarter-life crisis, and a lot more. I hope you enjoy the episode and thank you for listening.
This is On the Verge.
Hi, Carrie. Welcome to On the Verge.
Thanks so much for having me, Valentina.
I'm so excited to have you. And I was just telling you the story that I hadn't told you before about how I found your book. So for anyone listening, I'm going to show the book to those that see the video. Carrie is the writer of Private Equity. I was in the airport and I saw this in a bookshelf. And it caught my attention because it has the words private equity, massive, with a woman like giving her back, but she's in the center of this. And my brain went like, private equity and a woman front and center didn't fully make sense. So I was like, I'm so curious what this book is about. And then I read the description and it's very on topic with a lot of the things that I've been going through and that I've been talking about, especially like what's the meaning of work, what's the meaning of our lives in general. And yeah, I was sold right away, got it, read it in, I think, 3 days.
Oh, wow.
So for those that might not have read it, would you mind giving some background? What's the book about? And yeah, what's the main point of it?
Sure. My book is my story, one woman's journey of self-discovery. It happens to be set in the world of Manhattan hedge funds and the world of private equity. But this, it was through my work and through my job that I really came to discover myself. And the book starts when I'm 29 years old and I moved to New York. And I was just feeling so lost and adrift and just like kind of floating, and I didn't know what I was doing. And a recruiter reached out to me and gave me this opportunity that, you know, I had to go through 14 interviews to get the opportunity, but
wow.
Really,
that's,
you know,
so wild.
Yeah. And it was, do you want to be the right-hand person to this hedge fund billionaire?
Yeah.
It was hard to say no, you know, because at that time I really felt I needed some just forward momentum in something to, give me the kind of, direction and kind of anchor and stability that I needed to then discover myself. So yeah.
I think that's a very common theme for people in their 20s. Why did you feel the need to tell the story? Like, anyone who read the book probably already knows that the dream was always to be a writer.
Yes.
Like, this is mentioned since the beginning. It's
yes.
Not that this happened to you and then suddenly you went like, I'm going to write a book about this. But why did you choose particularly to share this story? What's the point of it? What do you want to give to the world from sharing
right.
this?
That's a great question because, you know, I have always wanted to be a writer, actually. And then I, especially during my 20s, took a bunch of detours, both in terms of, I mean, definitely in terms of career, but also, you know, I document my dating, you know, mishaps in the book, and just
yeah.
I was going.
You share it all.
Yeah, I share it all. My difficult relationship with my parents, and you know, and so, I've always wanted to be a writer, but I wasn't always clear on. Well, how, you know, was I going to? It wasn't always clear I was going to write a memoir. It also wasn't clear to me, you know, maybe I would start my memoir from childhood to adulthood linearly. But really, I chose to tell this story because the ages 29 to 31 were the most intense, pivotal, transformative years of my life. And I just really wanted to capture that, like, extreme growth and transformation that I experienced. And I, even years after the experience, I couldn't answer the question, what had happened to me? Everything was happening just so fast, so quickly, and just everything was so intense. You know, my job, I experienced severe burnout.
Yeah. you even know, had an injury related to
I had a
you read the
major
book, like, you'll see. there's a lot.
There's a lot. You know, and I was going through that. The job was really costing me my mental and physical health. And so, but more than that, I really wanted to show kind of the in detail the nuance and complexity of how I came to know myself, the growing kind of the changing consciousness I wanted to show on the page, and how I went from, you know, at the beginning of the book, I can say I was like fairly actually naive on just many things about the world. And, you know, I went in with such high ideals for kind of literally everything. I say in the book, I believe in good billionaires, you know, and towards the end of the book, you know, that viewpoint changes. And it's not like I flip-flop just to the other side. I didn't swing from one pendulum to the other side, but really it was to develop this more complex, nuanced view of the world. And I was only able to do that if I focused on those 2 years of extreme change.
Yeah. Do you think this more nuanced way of seeing the world changed everything for you, not only like the perception of others? Because, for example, you were saying like you believed in the good in everything, right? Even from the funds to the people, to also maybe a word like success that we use so often. Maybe you went into this job thinking that success meant one thing and then maybe left thinking it means another thing. I was thinking, for example, you're now a published author, and I think to some people that's like peak success versus to others, it's like you left a massive investment firm. Like, how are you going to do that? Are you crazy? That is what success means to someone else. And it always seems like things change just according to where you're standing from. Did the word success take a new meaning for you?
Great question, because it absolutely did. And I have been getting some version of "you're crazy, what are you doing?" like all my life.
Oh my God, yeah.
You know, and so you know, I as I detailed very early in the book, I went to MIT, I double majored and minored, graduated in 3 years, started immediately working on I think Fidelity is part of Wall Street, even though they're in Boston, you know, on the quantitative equity side. I was on the investment side. I was quickly promoted and then promoted again. And I had a very fast track. I love the work, not the culture. And we can get into that later. But like, I love the work. And so I did have this, you know, successful career. I was very quickly making, you know, this was in the late aughts, $300,000, which, you know, now would be even more, you know. And so I was in my early 20s making that money. And to some people, that might seem like success, but I was not one of those people who knew exactly what I wanted to do when I was younger. Like, I did not have that self-knowledge, and I felt so constrained. I wanted to experiment. I wanted to just go do other things. The more I worked in that job and the more money I was paid, the more I wanted to get out. And I didn't know how to really just give myself that permission to leave, you know? And so I was actually at that job for 4.5 years, going on 5 years. I made a lot of money, was, you know, my titles were great, but it wasn't what I wanted to do. So I quit that job to start business school. So to your point of success, so that was my first like quitting. I quit that job and people were like, "What are you doing?" Like, I already, at the time that I quit, I had a job title that people had after business school. So it was like, why would I go to business school and take a step back, you know, to like not make money, actually pay money to take a step back. But I knew I just needed the time and space, again, going back to self-discovery, to really discover myself. So that was the first moment where a lot of people were like, "What are you doing? Why would you quit? Like, you can make the change and not quit, you know?" And it's like, well, I don't know. I really, what I want is time, you know? Time is a luxury. Yeah. And in my 20s, I was like itching to, I felt like I was on the wrong track. So I really just needed to give myself time in my 20s. So then I quit. Then I got to Wharton. I was in this joint master's and like international relations and MBA program. You get to do all of it in 2 years. And I started there, but quickly realized that this is also not what I want to do. And, you know, primarily because, you know, going to business school is expensive.
Super expensive.
Yeah, super expensive, just tuition and room and board and all, you know, all these things. And I wasn't sure that the career that I would want after my MBA would be would be remunerative enough to pay back my, you know, my yeah. investment that these 2 years would cost me. And so I ended up quitting. I quit Wharton, and by then everyone was like,
you must be crazy.
I got that, so, like Carrie has completely gone off.
She's lost it.
Yeah, she's lost it. There's like something wrong with her. I got that a lot. And you know, I have to say, like, quitting Wharton was one of the most freeing moments of my life, as I write in the book, because I did something solely for myself, but everyone else was kind of doubting me. And you know, I do want to talk a little bit about the personal aspect, because I do think the personal and the work all relate to each other. So when I quit Wharton, or dropped out rather, I started dating somebody at the time, and it was the same relationship that I detail in the book. And he is a person of means, and he comes from a family of quite extreme wealth, and he, in the beginning, was actually very supportive of my career, and he told me he would be supportive just in the general sense, not like just like time, you know, effort of my career.
And emotional support.
Exactly. And so, you know, I quit, but ultimately, with hindsight, the decision had nothing to do with him. You know, I wanted to give myself that space, but it coincided with starting to date him. And so many people were like, you're ruining your career for a man. What are you doing? Like, how could you ruin your career for a man? And it was like, well, I don't know if it's for him, it's for me, but I just need to do this. I didn't know how else to explain that decision, except I just had to do it. And, you know, I didn't, to be honest, I'm not even sure that I had the self-confidence then to say out loud to other people that I was doing it for myself. Somehow just saying something like you're doing it for yourself feels not good enough. You have to be doing it for some bigger purpose or whatever. And so, yeah, I dropped out. Sorry, this is a long-winded answer to your question about success, because I have a very complicated relationship
with it.
And because I've gotten so many mixed messages about success.
You know what I find really interesting as well? Like, as you're telling this story, it's also, there's always the external opinion of what you were doing. And I find it crazy that so many times, instead of going like to ourselves to be like, how do I feel about my decision? We get so many inputs from everyone around us that we need to find a justification, not for us, but for them.
Exactly.
Being like, oh, this is okay for me to do because they've approved. And also, like, it's like, who's even they?
Yeah.
I think for a lot of people, it's parents, it's friends, it's college, like whoever it is. But I do think success as well has taken, it's been a social construct. So it seems that success only means so if it has been deemed approved by everyone around you.
Yes. And, you know, so much of my 20s, I was kind of, again, now only in my 30s, I was kind of seeking this, not just external validation, but kind of like permission from other people to say like what you're doing is okay and valid. And it's like, really, I want to be able to give myself that permission, you know, because doing it for myself is enough. Yes. And, you know, I didn't have it at that time in my 20s, but that's why I wrote the book to show other people and really come to understand myself and the process. But so on, continuing on your comment about success, so then after I dropped out of Wharton, so I had been called an overachiever all my life. like during my middle school, high school years, definitely during college, you know, just because I was always in high
school. Track and advanced.
Yeah, exactly. Like
you were in the fast track.
I was on the fast track. Like in high school, I spent most of my later 2 years taking honors college classes at Michigan State University. And I was in like junior level honors physics, you know, and like taking like just really intense courses. And so, but then when I dropped out and I was like, actually, you know, so after dropping out, it's not like I went to anything. I just gave myself space. You could say I was unemployed because it's true. I was. But, you know, technically I wasn't seeking employment, you know, but I was not employed to give myself this time. And instead I was taking classes for fun as a non-degree student at like NYU, University of Michigan, also MIT again, in English literature, creative writing, philosophy, and I had the best time. But other people were saying to me, because those classes weren't going toward a degree, it wasn't toward an end goal. It was just completely for me. Again, it was, what are you doing? So I got a lot of like, are you underachieving? You know? And I remember I must be in my mid to later 20s at that time. Someone from my MIT year said to me, oh, I had expected you to be on the cover of Forbes by now. And I was like, well, no, because I don't want to be that, you know? And it's just such a like external, it's those external expectations that we might have that kind of sow seeds of self-doubt in us about what we're doing, when in fact it's like, I don't want that at all. So to your, again, back to success, like, I think sometimes what looks like going backwards to others is actually you moving forward. So success for just yourself, you know? And so the years after, between dropping out of Wharton and then, you know, getting the job that I detail in private equity, I, to everyone in the world, probably looked like I was going backwards. You know, I was not making money. I was actually burning through my savings to go on this journey of self-discovery. Yeah, exactly. Because, you know, gaining self-knowledge is expensive because we need to live and, you know, eat and just do all these things. And so I definitely was going backwards in the financial sense. My net worth definitely declined. A lot. But in some ways, I was also so happy.
Yeah, because, much richer emotionally. Yeah. And
yes.
Yeah. And knowledge about yourself, that it's such an important knowledge to have. The fact that someone tells you like that it's a waste of your time to learn things just to grow, that's crazy to me, because what are you doing if you're not trying to get to know yourself? And learn for the sake of learning doesn't have to always be like for financial reasons or for a job, for a degree.
Exactly.
You should enjoy it.
Exactly. And so, you know, because I had been so go on a, you know, the proverbial treadmill all my life, I wanted to get off the treadmill and just kind of take this time for myself. And then, but it was, you know, it's just very interesting because in some ways, you know, I in terms of my earnings, I kind of peaked earlier in my life and kind of have been declining somewhat since then, you know, even though I still was very well compensated in my hedge fund jobs. But certainly, so you say the writing, right? Like I have published my first book and, you know, I consider that a great success because it's one of my dreams since very early childhood. And I continue to hope to write many more books. But at the same time, to some people, it might seem like I'm not so successful because, you know, I just very honestly like make less now.
Didn't guide it on economic earnings.
Yeah. Exactly. So, and you know, but to me, I honestly feel richer than ever.
Yeah. Yeah. No, that's, and I think also knowing your journey from the book, you realize that life sometimes takes you, you took your time after Penn, but then kind of the finance world drew you in again.
Yes.
And you came out the other end even more sure about yourself, what you wanted, and look at you now, like you wrote the book. So everything, I hate when people are like, oh, everything happens for a reason, but sometimes like the path is just not that linear.
Yes.
You'll improve, then you might go back, and then so getting a bit into the world of finance, because it is pretty main stage in the book, what do you think draws people to this world so much? What are, and I guess it's good to focus a bit on the good and the bad, what do you think is a better like aspect of the finance world, and what is the biggest cultural problem that you see, not only at the investment firm that you were in, because honestly, even relative to other places, it's probably even culturally better, because you mentioned that one at your first job, it was probably culturally much worse than at your second one in some aspects, not with the you having no life and living for someone else, that's terrible as well. What are some of the takeaways that you have from the industry?
So the finance industry, I have to say, I still continue to feel this way about the industry, is that to me, certainly both at Fidelity and the two other hedge funds that I worked at, just in terms of people, I wanted to be surrounded by people who strove for the best of the best. And there was something really exciting about being surrounded by people who were really smart, who wanted to do things, go places. And that ambition itself was just so inspiring. Environment of excellence and striving to be, this phrase is in the book, but just the best in the world at everything. And even if people don't end up at that, best in the world, just that striving itself was just, it was intoxicating to me. And it still is, because I'm just really interested in, I still am interested in the concept of self-improvement and, how to do more. I think it's very human to want to there's this concept of mastery, master.
Get really good.
Exactly. Get really good at anything. And it doesn't matter exactly what it is. And so it was really just mesmerizing to me, especially the fund that I was at in the book, where everyone just wanted to master pretty much every aspect of life. I think there are downsides to that when you take that approach to the extreme.
I think it's easy to get there if you read the book.
Yeah, exactly. It'll be very obvious, I think. and I think just sort of the more difficult part of finance, and I really have to say, and because this is, I think, one of my main points or messages in the book, is it's not even so much about finance. It's just about work culture in general in America. And to your point, the fun that I was in the book, I think many people would probably I've definitely gotten this, is it didn't seem that bad. And it's okay, so let's unpack that. But yes, so compared to many other cultures that we might, know of or, hear of, both certainly in the Wall Street and, there's a trope of horrible bosses, or, that's an archetype for a reason.
Yes.
My boss wasn't. He was so, I think he genuinely cared to try to help me succeed. And he thinks everything he was doing was trying to help me become a better worker. Not necessarily a better person, just a better worker for him. He never yelled at me. He compensated me really well. He never made me cry. And I'm so sad to say that that's such a low bar.
I think it's a key point that you're making, of it's a cultural thing, because maybe in America, people would be like, oh, isn't that bad then? Your boss didn't call you horrible things.
Yeah.
It's not that bad. Yeah. Like in finance, it happens.
It happens.
How do we normalize that?
Exactly. We've normalized things to expect that basic expectations are you know, a kind of gift. That's something I'm definitely trying to show just in narrative form in my book. But also, so to get back to the problematic aspect of finance in my book, but writ large of society, is just there is this big power imbalance between owners and workers, just, you know, the management and the people in power and the employers and employees. And no matter how, quote, nice your workplace is and, you know, how they treat you just in terms of compensation, gifts. Now, of course, those can also be golden handcuffs. At the end of the day, there's just such a big power imbalance that no matter how nice my boss is, when I try to speak up, I'm not sure that he heard me, because the big power imbalance is that in terms of like decision making, primarily regarding my day, my hours, and he controlled all my hours. He had absolute say in how I worked, what I worked, how much I worked. And so I don't feel like I had any agency or control or autonomy over my day. And that is such a problem. And it affects not only knowledge-intensive jobs, both in finance and just, you know, just knowledge workers, but also low-wage workers too, who, you know, don't know their working schedule the next week. And so I think this is the primary problem of working culture.
Wow. I haven't heard this take. I don't think so. It's a very good description of something that's affecting work culture in general. I love that you didn't just make it about finance. I think it is very prominent in finance, and there's a lot of problematic aspects. I think one that you also get into that I'm always interested in gender studies things. Yeah. You do mention a pretty bad situation at your first job.
Yes.
Was being a woman challenging in the industry at times? Do you think gender roles are truly improving as much as people say they are? And going into the particular situation, sorry, I know this is a lot of questions given just one topic, but the situation that you lived through, you decided not to speak up, not to say anything. How do you feel about that situation now? And would you go about it the same way?
Yeah. So in that situation, there was just rampant sexual harassment at my job. I just kind of ignored all of it. I mean, it was certainly red flags. It certainly made my life very difficult. And the harassment really started, even though I did not think it such and did not label it such, but it really even started during my interviews where, you know, an older male interviewer, you know, asked me my ethnicity. Well, he was just like, "Are you Chinese?" "My wife's Chinese." And it's like, great, you know?
Yeah.
So, and then he proceeded to, like, after I started work, invite me into his cubicle, or no, he came to my cubicle and wanted to watch a long video together about yellow fever. Like, and he laughed, and I didn't find it funny. And then, you know, just like very inappropriate. I mean, even though, you know, these are lines that are crossed, right? Like, he never touched me, but it doesn't have to be physical to be harassment, you know?
It's already uncomfortable. Like, the fact that you're uncomfortable at the workplace, it's not okay.
Yeah. And I just kind of, I felt like it wasn't okay. I felt like boundaries were violated, but I just really wanted to focus on my work. I just wanted to do my work well. And I really felt like speaking up would detract from like just doing my work. And because I didn't want any man to like slow me down and affect my, you know, marks during, you know, reviews and performance reviews and bonuses. And so I just kind of ignored everything. And then it culminated, it got worse over the years. At my last holiday party with the firm, this one traitor, he came up to me and just whispered some really, really inappropriate things in my ear. This part isn't in the book, but he also then touched me at like just, yeah. So, and this was at the holiday party. And that got bad enough that I asked people who I trusted.
This is in the book. This shocked me.
Yeah.
Yes.
I asked one of my friends, I considered him a friend, what I should do about this situation, because this is what happened. And I felt like I actually felt like I had to speak up.
Yeah, a line was crossed.
Yeah, a line was crossed. And I wanted to do it for myself and for just the culture of that firm in general and for women everywhere. And he said to me, well, this friend who I trusted, who was also white and male, and you know, you kind of get the story that the place I worked at was very white and very male.
surprise, surprise.
Exactly. And he said, well, you don't want to ruin his like family, do you? Like, you don't want to ruin his life. And it's like, why would me speaking up about his boundary crossing and harassment?
Yeah, he shouldn't do it.
He shouldn't do it. So he's ruining his life. I'm not ruining his life, you know? Yeah. But that just, it broke my heart when that happened, because I'm just like, wow, that is the assumption for even people who, you know, are on my side. And at that time, I had already gotten into Wharton, and I felt like it just was not going to be worth my time, really, to speak up, because, you know, since we're getting into it, I also had a similar experience at MIT where it was a lot worse. It was actually a sexual assault. I think it officially is classified as a rape. This was first semester of my college experience, and I reported it, and I filed an official Title IX complaint, and there was a hearing, and he was found not guilty, not responsible. And that experience just completely, completely destroyed me. And I, at that point, to go through, to speak up and do what I felt like was right, that actually cost me a lot. It cost me my grades. It cost me just, I could not focus on school at all. I had incompletes in my classes, and like, you know, anyone who knows me and...
You're clearly a very high-performing person.
Yeah, yeah. I could not. It like completely destroyed my college experience. And just requiring so much emotional energy, time, and just sacrifice. And so I wasn't ready to go through that experience again. At my first job on Wall Street.
And also that the outcome is not even positive. You're like, you go through all this to get nothing good out of it. Then something happens to you again and you're like, why should I even bother? And I think the main issue here in a lot of circumstances, and I think this happens in the finance industry a lot, it seems that gender issues are women issues for women to fix.
Yes.
And that men can just... whatever.
Yes.
Do you think there are generalized problems still in the culture, or is it truly improving as much as people say it is?
You know, great question. I haven't officially worked in the industry since 2018, but I will say that I think it's not going to improve materially until we get more women in more positions of power. And so, you know, recently I was just following the kind of Goldman Sachs and their lack of women in the upper echelons of management and executive positions. And they end up just quitting. And it's like, well, is it really because there are no qualified women at that level, or is it? No, it's not.
No, it doesn't make sense.
Exactly.
There's no
way. So until we have women with, you know, promoted to as they deserve to those levels where they can then influence culture, I think culture is just changing at the margins at best, because I really think working culture trickles down. I think it flows from top down, and it's not, you know, up to the rank and file employees and just, you know, the average employee.
Yeah. No, and it's, I think the lead by example shows everywhere.
Yes.
And if the top of the firm thinks one way, it does transmit to employees that that's the norm and the way to think and how employees should act. So I think this topic can go on forever. And I wish there was more that had been done to, like, to, for true change, because I think a lot of companies just put out in the world the things that they're doing right, but they hide the true,
yes,
the true, like, spaces where it didn't actually change that much.
Exactly. Yeah. And, like, I'll give you another, just like, this is such, to me, an obvious thing, but it's like another biggie. It's like another cultural problem hidden in plain sight, which is just, even cultures that have an attitude of, like, extra attention to gender issues, the working culture itself still prioritizes a type of work where you need to drop everything at a moment's notice to do work. And the only people, and the reason why that is a gendered workplace culture, is because women still often have to take on an unequal amount of just care work and life work, life maintenance work. You know, even in, even if just obviously childcare and also parental care falls a lot more on women. But even if you're just in a relationship and it's like you're living together with a guy, a lot of the relationship life apartment work falls on women. And so the people who are able to drop everything at a hat, like on a just moment's own notice, and go to work and do that,
it's usually men.
And so that feels very, very gendered to me. And
that's an interesting addition as well. I hadn't thought of it that way. I hadn't thought of that as a gendered thing, but that's such a good point that you bring. Another thing that I wanted to get into, because I think I related to it a lot. There's a lot about your parents in the book and being raised with certain expectations. I think, as I was telling you, I started my career in finance as well. And I can 100% in retrospect and with a lot of therapy work see that I was making a lot of choices based on my father's ideas and not my own. And I think this is something that happens to a lot of people, that they are in their 20s or even in college choosing what to study, and their families have told them that there are certain things that are right, certain things that are wrong. And oftentimes we shut our own opinions and put our parents' opinions above our own. Do you think your family background made you take certain career paths? Was this a conditioning thing? And what would you say to someone that might be in the position that you were of making certain decisions with a family background that was quite strict and that had very high expectations on your performance and choices?
Yeah, that's such a great question, because it's so complicated with my parents, as it sounds like it was with your, especially your father.
It too. Still is.
It like, still
it's
is.
It's a constant thing that you it's have a constant to work thing. On.
Yeah, it's not like, anything is like permanently solved. But so it's very interesting because, you know, I'm Chinese American. And so there's this concept of like tiger parent, tiger mother. It's very interesting whether my parents were actually tiger. Like, they were very controlling in many ways, but they also never asked to see a report card. They never like necessarily pushed me in any one direction. But what I have to say is I have actually felt so much parental pressure my entire life. And to get a little into what that means, I think my parents, my parents had survived the Cultural Revolution in China. And the way they survived that tumultuous time was through, I think they are incredibly smart and brilliant and gifted, but they also survived through their just work ethic was extremely intense. And they have this extremity about them and intensity that and high work ethic at the cost of everything else. It helped them survive, brutal times in China. And so when they got to America, you know, I think I kind of absorbed a lot of that. A lot of that just, whatever happens, you have to just eat your suffering, eat your bitterness, and just continue to work, not complain. And beyond that, just, you know, as I said, my parents are extreme and intense. And I think I got a lot of that, which made me feel kind of at home in the work culture that I show in my book. So it kind of prepared me for that. But more than anything, I think my parents, and you were talking about like values and just like expectations. Mm-hmm. And my parents, it's funny, they're not status driven at all. They're actually not money driven at all, but they push me to do the best in the world at everything. Mm. Because to them, that was the only possible way to survive. And the reason is, all they want, so their primary value is stability mm. and security. And they, you know, actually correctly sensing the world, just like certainly economically, but just in terms of climate change, the world is getting more and more precarious. To even stay at your whatever current level, let's just say, you want to stay middle class, like you have to work harder and harder just to stay where you are, you know, and never mind like moving up. And so they just want me to be stable. They want me to have a stable job, but they think the only way to do that is if you're at the top. And so if you're at the top, nothing can affect you and you will have options and you will be able to survive. So their whole thing was all about survival, you know, and the corollary to that is safety. They wanted me to choose also things that are both like high success and safe and secure
and stable,
and stable. And but that is just, as I come to discover in my 20s, so antithetical to my personality and everything that I want in life, you know.
Yeah.
And so through my parents, I inherited a set of values and worldview and a work ethic. And much of it, I think, has a lot, I do actually independently now think much of it has a lot of value for me. But it was my coming of age, as it were, it was really to learn about which parts of that thing that I inherited doesn't work for me.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's such a beautiful way to put it, because I think a lot of people, when you talk about your parents, and I'm not saying particularly you, I'm saying anyone, it's like as if you were criticizing them. But I think it's a natural step of growing up,
yes,
deciding what you want to take from them and what you want to leave behind.
Yes.
And it's only fair, and it's not like you're blaming them, because you also understand, you know your parents' stories. You know, like, they want the best for you, and that's why they have put certain ideas and certain pressures to you. But the process of deciding what you take and what you don't can be painful at times, and it's hard, but yes, you must do it.
Yeah, you must do it. And I think I say in my book, and true, the first time I speak up to my parents ever, just like the first time I ever disagreed with anything they said, I was 28.
Yeah, so that's crazy.
It's like, you know, and my mom is, and this is also in the book, my mom would be like, she calls me a prostitute for wearing, you know, tank tops and eyeshadow. And I'm like, okay.
You know? Yeah.
She's like, I do something she doesn't like, and she's, you know, her go-to
she's
line.
She's not saving her opinions.
Yeah, she's not saving her any opinion. She's like, you're no longer my daughter. And I'm like, okay, whatever, you know. And it's like, actually, I don't feel okay, whatever. But my okay, whatever kind of ignoring of those things was a way to just survive. And
yeah. I think also this just leads to the idea that your book is a coming of age book.
Yes.
And I also like to see it as an existentialist book, because it's about the meaning of life.
Yes.
It's, in the end, the main question is, how do you want to live your life? How do you want to spend your time?
Yes.
What does work mean in your day-to-day life?
Yes.
I think with Gen Z, there's a whole movement that's very related to your book. So you're from a different generation, but a lot of the things you're saying, I think Gen Z are putting front and center. They're not shy about it.
Yes.
They don't think it's wrong. that's one of the most interesting switches in society. I really wonder what's going to happen when Gen Z is the leader in the workspace and what's going to happen.
Oh, yeah.
But to talk about a bit about the meaning of work in your life, what role did it have back then versus how do you view work now? And I like the quotes that is in the introduction that you said about when you were sick, that you decided, let me read it. You said, one, I will make the most out of each and every day and do something of value with my life. Two, I will be a good person. Thank you. What is doing something of value with your life?
Great question. I still have those two value. I still have those two aims in my life. Those are what I have continued to feel gives me meaning. But I think the value really changed. I used to define value, to get back to my parents a little bit. My parents, it was my parents' definition of value, which was work as much as possible. You know, even during, like, for example, during spring break, I have finished all my homework. I have finished all the extra credit. And they're like, what are you doing watching, you know, television at 3 p.m.? You should be studying. And I'm like, well, I have nothing to study. It's like, it doesn't matter. I have to be working all the time. And so certainly at the time that I wrote that, which was that's a scene from middle school years, all the way up to the job in the book, Private Equity, my definition of value was just as much work as possible. And that's how much I valued work. I mean, I sort of laugh and cringe at myself now, but it was, and it wasn't just like work for the sake of work. It was like, I wanted high quality work that would, like, you know, make them proud, really. Mm-hmm. I felt like because they had sacrificed so much, I had to do the right thing by honoring what they had sacrificed to give me.
That's a heavy burden.
It's a heavy burden. And so the value was really just do as much work as possible while trying to be a good person. So kind of those two things led me exactly to this job, because this job, my boss in the job, you know, the founder, owner of the firm, was like, I believe in morality. I believe in ethics. Like, I care to do the right thing. And I want to work all the time. And I was like, great, I'm in.
Right,
yeah, exactly. And so kind of, you know.
Best place in the world.
Yes, exactly. I really thought I was going to be at the firm forever, really. But as you say, my book is a coming of age. And it's primarily a professional coming of age. But it is also a holistic personhood, selfhood, yes, coming of age. And part of that coming of age is coming to realize that my definition of value is so not, I mean, it's definitely not my parents. It's my own. And what I have come to discover that I want out of value is, the funny thing is, I would say actually now, you know, with my freelance writing career, because I am a full-time author, I probably have worked more hours at this job than I did even in my last job, or on Wall Street. I actually, just in terms of hours, I probably do work more, but, and back to something we were talking about earlier, I have agency over those hours. I get to decide what I want to do, what is meaningful to me, what is of value to, you know, my career, my life, and that just freedom to mm-hmm. choose how to spend my hours and how to spend my days, and not just the quantity of hours, but the quality of those hours. I would not give that up for anything. And that's the value that I have today. So on some level, I'm still satisfying my parents'
You still goal. Work very hard.
Yeah, to work all the time. I still do. But The difference now is I have control over my days.
Yeah, and do something that you find of value and of meaning. And
yes.
That's so important. It's not to be undermined that your life is, you only live it once. Might as well do something that you find
yes.
relevant to the world.
And so, you know, the difference is, you know, I'm not, you know, when I was kind of in that like grind mindset, and also in the culture of New York, anyone in New York will know there's just such a hustle, statusy culture. You know, I have a friend in the book. She, at the time, she was in finance, but she was at an expert network that supports a lot of financial firms, and she had a big financial clients, and she was making $300,000 or over, and she felt that she felt so low. I mean, her text messages are in the book. Like, she felt like she couldn't keep up. She felt like her friends were going to ditch her for like not making enough money, because you know why? All our group, all the friends group, people would, and not to super get into social media, but you know, it was like, where did you vacation? Yeah. What, like, you know, world's top 50 restaurant did you go to this weekend? You know, were you able to fly to Croatia and back? It was just like that, just intense level of upkeep, you know? And for me, I quickly realized that it's not even, I don't care about that a little, I don't care about that at all. You know, most of my days are spent staring at a blank page, and, and I am beyond happy. I feel like I have everything I need in the world.
You're going within.
Yes.
More than to the outside.
Yes.
Carrie, I feel like I could ask you 300 questions, and I know we're on time, but just quickly, as brief as you can, because I know you have to go. This is a podcast for people in their 20s, and I think a lot of people might be going through a lot of things that you're going through in the book. What's one piece of advice that you would give them? Just a short one.
Short one. My main piece of advice is give yourself permission to not know yourself. Because I think culture right now overvalues not just confidence, but conviction. Just like knowing your next step. Like, it's okay to not know yourself. And don't judge yourself. Give yourself the time, really, to discover yourself. And I really think that that is the best gift that anyone in their 20s could give themselves.
I love that. Thank you so much again, Carrie. This was amazing. I think this is going to be a great listen for a lot of people. And everyone, go read the book. It's fantastic. Thank you for coming on.
Thank you so much, Valentina.